Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at the figure of the prophet Elijah as a model of intercessory prayer and to help people turn away from every form of idolatry. U.S. Bishops Spring Assembly. It's a matter of life and death. We find out why the bishops at their current assembly are debating and voting on a document on physician-assisted suicide, among a number of other issues. St. John Newman. On the bicentenary of his birth, Cardinal Justin Regali of Philadelphia talks to us about why the legacy of John Newman, the first U.S. bishop to be canonized, lives on to this day. And the wonder of creation. Listen to our latest reflection on the environment and the gift of God's creation. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of the prophet Elijah as a model of intercessory prayer, who urged people to reject every form of idolatry. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Thousands of pilgrims and visitors withstood the high midday temperatures in St. Peter's Square this June Wednesday to hear the latest installment in Pope Benedict XVI's series of lessons on Christian prayer. This week, focusing on the power of intercessory prayer, drawn from the biblical episode of Elijah's prayer on Mount Carmel.
At a time when the kingdom of Israel saw the spread of Baal worship and syncretism, Elijah invited the people to renew their covenant with the Lord and to reject every form of idolatry. In the episode of his contest with the priests of Baal on Mount Carmel, he calls upon Israel to choose the Lord and prays for their conversion of heart. What is more, he urges the people themselves to draw near and share in his prayer.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict reflected on the dangers of idolatry present today. He said idolatry is the constant temptation of the believer, who fools himself into believing that he can serve two masters, who tries to serve the Almighty, placing his trust in impotent man-made gods. Pope Benedict continued, "Man should worship only God, because there where God disappears, man becomes the slave of idolatry. The worship of idols, instead of opening hearts to the otherness that allows us to go out from narrow horizons of selfishness, closes the person into the exclusive and desperate circle of the search for self."
As we look to Elijah's example, let us be even more convinced of the power of intercessory prayer, so that we can help all people to know the one true God, to turn away from every form of idolatry, and to receive the grace offered to us on the wood of the cross and in the fire of the Holy Spirit.
Finally, Pope Benedict XVI greeted all English-speaking pilgrims present in St. Peter's Square this Wednesday.
"I welcome the members of the Catholic Pentecostal International Dialogue, and I offer prayerful good wishes for the next phase of their work. I thank the choirs, and particularly the University Choir from Indonesia, for their praise of God in song. Finally, I greet the delegates to the General Chapter of the Congregation of Resurrection. Upon all English-speaking pilgrims, especially those from the Philippines, Canada, and the United States, I invoke the Lord's blessings of joy and peace."
The General Audience was Pope Benedict XVI's last public encounter before his departure on Sunday for the Diocese of San Marino Montefeltro. I'm Emma McCarthy.
This is much more than another choice in your life. This is a matter of life and death.
That's how a senior spokesperson for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, or USCCB, describes the impact of one of the key issues being discussed by the prelates at their current Spring General Assembly in Seattle. Those remarks refer to the subject of assisted suicide, as the bishops are scheduled to debate and vote on a document on this issue at their three-day meeting. Entitled To Live Each Day with Dignity, the document is the first statement on assisted suicide issued by the full body of the USCCB. So what prompted the US bishops to draw up such a document, and what other issues are on the agenda at their meeting this week? To find out more, I spoke to Sister Mary Ann Walsh, Director of Media Relations at the USCCB.
Well, the meeting is being held in the state of Washington, and Washington, along with Oregon, are two states in the United States that have approved legislation that permits a physician-assisted suicide. This is a grave concern to the U.S. bishops, because you see policy being established, or people attempting to establish policies all around the nation on assisted suicide, which is making people's lives, particularly lives of the sick, feel less valued. It is completely against respect for the dignity of every person. And the bishops want to make sure that people know that this is not the right way to go. There are options. There is palliative care. There is hospice. There is other medical care. And even ignoring the fact that we have all these hospices and palliative care, there's an intrinsic dignity of human life that is being completely rejected by the proponents of euthanasia.
And how strong are the proponents of euthanasia or the assisted suicide movement in the U.S. in general?
Well, it's hard to predict. They've been successful in two of the states, so that is a concern. Ideas that you thought a few years ago were unheard of or laughable are becoming acceptable, and so I think the bishops feel that they have got to speak out now so that Catholic people and the general public are well-armed for these debates, so they really understand the issues. This is much more than another choice in your life. This is a matter of life and death.
And can you tell us, what are some of the main points on this draft document?
Well, the document speaks about the hardships and fears of patients who are facing terminal illness and the importance of life-affirming palliative care. People shouldn't feel that they're a burden to society, and we want to make sure that they understand that they have inherent worth as individuals. The document cites the Church's concern for those who are tempted to commit suicide, its opposition to a physician-assisted suicide. I mean, people who are chronically ill, people who are dying, can feel suicidal if they're not supported by the community around them, assuring them that their life has value. There are two things that people fear when they're dying or at the end of life. One is pain, and the other is isolation. Well, pain can be handled rather expeditiously by the medical community. They are much more advanced in pain control now than they ever were. And the rest of the Christian community certainly can deal with isolation in that we support people. We give them the message, you are not alone. So these are points that are of concern to the bishops and that come out in this document.
Do the bishops also fear that voluntary, so-called voluntary assisted suicide, is the first step on a slippery slope down to involuntary euthanasia?
Well, yes, that certainly is a concern, because you can go quickly from helping someone to take their life because they don't have any hope to deciding to take someone's life because you don't have any belief in their future. So you quickly get away from what, you know, people want for themselves. And the cost consciousness emphasis, particularly in medical care, if you put that along with the possibility of, well, let's end it all here and save a lot of money, you're slipping into a very barbaric attitude toward human life.
Now, another item on the agenda at this meeting is revisions on the Charter on the Protection of Children and Young People. What are these revisions and why are they being proposed?
Well, every document certainly can get better, so that's certainly an underlying reason for improving the Charter. But the Charter has to be brought in line with the recent Vatican changes. As you recall, last year, the Vatican was stressing that pornography, child pornography, explicitly ought to be mentioned. Now, implicitly, it's in there, in that any external violation of the Sixth Commandment is a violation of the Charter. But putting it in that you really mean child pornography makes it that much stronger. Secondly, as you know, the Vatican last year pointed out that while this is a charter for the protection of youth or children and young people, is also to be included in that are people who have the mental capacity, children or young people, because they've been developmentally disabled. And so to specifically point out that these people are also protected, so to speak, by the charter.
Yes, like in England, I know that they have a charter for young people and what they call vulnerable adults.
That's exactly. This is exactly the people. Vulnerable adults will be mentioned specifically in this charter.
Right, also on the bishop's agenda is a presentation on the defence of marriage efforts by the USCCB. What does this consist of?
Well, the Defence of Marriage Project has many facets to it, one of which is noting the need to oppose statutes which would make a gay marriage or homosexual marriage, using the word marriage is wrong there, a union as a marriage. Bishops believe, and the church believes, that a marriage is a union between a man and a woman. It is not between a man and a man or a woman and a woman. So that's part of the defense of marriage. The secondly is an education campaign on what marriage means to people and the importance of the basic understanding of Catholic marriage, that it involves, as I said, a man and a woman, that the only acceptable sexual relationships in the church are within the sacrament of marriage. So it's educating people further on the understanding of marriage.
Is the institution of marriage very much under attack, do you feel, or do the bishops feel that the institution of marriage is very much under attack at the moment in the U.S.?
I think that attack is a strong word. Attack sounds more obvious than it is. It's being undermined. I mean, there's nobody out there saying, let's get marriage. But surely marriage is being undermined when you can create other institutions that are supposed to be equal to it. I mean, marriage is the bedrock of our society. There is no other institution comparable to it. And the church objects to saying that there is.
The bishops are also scheduled to hear a report by Cardinal Donald Wuerl of Washington on the Vatican guideline for allowing communities of Anglicans to enter into full communion with the Catholic Church, the Anglicanorum Caritas. What is this report saying?
Well, we haven't seen the report yet, but I imagine it will be Cardinal Wuerl is bringing the bishops up to date on progress toward establishing such an ordinariate in our country. As you know, it already is established in England, and there are efforts to establish it in other countries, I believe also Australia. And so it's an information report. Now, right here in the Archdiocese of Washington, a parish has come into the Catholic Church. Now, this parish is coming in, an Anglican parish, planning to be part of an ordinariate not yet to be established, but that will be established. So this allows Anglican groups to come in as one body and to retain many of the customs and liturgical rites from their Anglican tradition.
And do you have any idea how many Anglicans, or Episcopalians, should I say, in the U.S. have already approached the Catholic Church with a view to entering into communion with it, becoming part of this ordinariate when it's set up? Do we have any kind of idea on numbers?
We understand that there have been many people who have approached Cardinal Wuerl. Cardinal Wuerl is coordinating this for the bishops in the United States. But at this point, before the report is given, I don't have any numbers.
And what other topics are being discussed by the bishops at this assembly?
Well, they're approving presumably will approve a document on preaching. That's an effort that the bishops have had on the burners for several years. And so it's to develop a document which is involved in how do you improve preaching in the parishes. Preaching, obviously, is very important for educating our people, and even for bringing people into the church. I asked somebody once, what do you do when you're bringing someone into the church? What are you looking for? He said, well, I'd start with good music, readings that are presented well, and a good homily. This is people's introduction into the Catholic Church. And so there's a need to improve the preaching that people hear. So that's one of the issues. Another issue is the bishops will be considering faithful citizenship, which is a document that they produce every 4 years about the obligations of citizens in a democratic society to be involved in the political landscape.
I was speaking to Sister Marianne Walsh, Director of Media Relations at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. This week sees the bicentenary of the birth of St. John Newman, the first U.S. bishop to be canonized. He was born in Bohemia in what is now the Czech Republic, and Cardinal Justin Rogali of Philadelphia, the same see where St. John was bishop, has been appointed as the papal legate at celebrations marking the 200th anniversary of Newman's birth in his home country. John Newman was born in 1811, and after not succeeding in his keen desire to be ordained as a priest in his native Bohemia, moved to the United States, where he was ordained in the Diocese of New York. In 1842, he joined the Order of the Redemptorists, a congregation of priests and brothers dedicated to helping the poor and most abandoned, and 6 years later was appointed the Order's provincial superior in the U.S., In 1852, he was appointed Bishop of Philadelphia, where he was the first to organize a diocesan Catholic school system. John Newman died of a stroke at the age of 48 and was canonized by Pope Paul VI in 1977. These are the bare bones of John Newman's life, but what were his greatest accomplishments, and how strongly does his legacy live on today in the U.S.? For an answer to those questions, I spoke to Cardinal Rigali in Philadelphia, the same city where the saint lived, died, and is buried.
Besides being the fourth bishop of Philadelphia and a very zealous bishop, a missionary bishop who came from his native Bohemia to preach the gospel here in the United States, besides all of that, he ends up being the first canonized male saint in the United States, the first bishop to become a saint. So that has tremendous effect on the United States, and his devotion is found in many places outside of Philadelphia.
Tell us briefly about his life history and what kind of a man and what kind of a priest he was.
Well, he was born in Bohemia, and he obviously was attracted in his youth to the priesthood because he entered the seminary in his native land, and it wasn't, however, until he came to the United States that he was ordained a priest in New York. And at that time, he was only 26 years of age. And that began his whole activity, his missionary activity, his pastoral activity, and he served in New York, and he served other places. He served in Pennsylvania, he served in Maryland, and not too many years after he was ordained a priest, 6 years after that, he entered the Redemptorist Order. He himself experienced a need for community, and so he became actually the first Redemptorist to be professed in the United States. And he continued to serve a pastoral role in Baltimore, and he also became acquainted with Archbishop Kenrick, who at that time was the Archbishop of Baltimore. Eventually, he became the successor of Archbishop Kenrick, not in Baltimore, but in Philadelphia. So he became a bishop very young. He became a bishop in 1852, which meant he was 41 years of age. He was ordained a bishop on his birthday. His short pastoral role in Philadelphia concerned itself with great things. He had a great love for the people, a great love for the immigrants, a great love for the Holy Eucharist. He promoted 40 hours devotion in a very extraordinary way here in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. So he gave of himself, was always in order to help people to know the gospel and to live the gospel. He comes forth as a pastoral figure in the United States, a bishop of whom we are all very, very proud.
How strong is his legacy 200 years after his birth?
Well, you know, St. John Newman, he is buried right here in Philadelphia in St. Peter's Church. It was his desire to be buried there because he was a redemptorist. He's buried under the altar in the basement church, and there is a constant flow of pilgrims to this shrine. It was Pope John Paul II who came as a pilgrim in 1979. It was my great privilege for the first time in my life to visit St. John Newman together with John Paul II as he came to Philadelphia in 1979. But that pilgrimage is uninterrupted, and we have pilgrims always. His feast day is celebrated with great... His memory is very much alive, and his body remains with us.
And talking about his body, I gather one interesting point is that a stole that had been draped over the body of the saint was given as a gift by President Barack Obama to Pope Benedict when he came to the Vatican in 2009. Is that right? Do you know a little bit about the story behind that?
Well, the stole was actually a stole that had been on St. John Newman, I believe, and it belonged to the Redemptorist. So I believe that the president received it from the Redemptorist. It did not represent a gift of the Archdiocese. It was simply a stole that the Redemptorist had, and the president received it in some way, and he decided to give it to the Pope.
He was clearly an exceptional figure, but if you had to sum up, just say, one or two of his greatest accomplishments, what would you say they were?
Well, we would certainly talk in terms of how effective he was in promoting devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, promoting the aims of the Second Vatican Council, years in anticipation, the tremendous devotion that he personally had, the devotion that was established in the Archdiocese through the 40 hours devotion, and that was an extraordinary thing. Another thing that he did was his insistence on Catholic schools. And so he's looked upon as someone who did a great deal to lay the basis for Catholic schools in the United States. And that is an extraordinary accomplishment. Something else that he did was his extraordinary pastoral care for the immigrants. And Philadelphia was certainly a city of immigrants. He was blessed with native talent to speak languages, and therefore he made an effort to speak in a number of different languages. He could speak in German, he could speak in Italian, but he also learned Gaelic, because at that time there were the Irish who had come over, and some of them were Gaelic-speaking. So he made enough effort to be able to minister to them, to hear confessions in Gaelic. But the point is that he was so conscious of the cultural diversity that was present at that time and how pastorally it was so necessary to face this issue, face this question. And he did it himself as the bishop, leading the way and showing this tremendous pastoral love for the people of God.
Moving to the present, how is the 200th bicentenary of his birth in his native land of Bohemia, which is now, of course, the Czech Republic, how has it been celebrated there? Can you tell us a little bit about these celebrations?
The purpose of the celebration, I received a letter from the Holy Father in which he appointed me to be the papal legate, and one thing he said in that letter was very significant because it kind of zeroes in on the purpose of the celebration. And he says, as you speak of this distinguished man of the Church and of his untiring activity, you will encourage all those who participate in the event to show by the example of their daily life, by the renewed zeal of their piety, a special love for Christ and the gospel. So I believe that Holy Father is saying for the celebration of holiness in the Church, in this particular moment, St. John Newman becomes a challenge to all those who are celebrating this anniversary.
I was speaking to Cardinal Justin Rugali, Archbishop of Philadelphia. We now continue our series of reflections on the environment and God's creation, using as a springboard Pope Benedict's teachings on this key issue. Today's reflection comes from Father Robert King, the interfaith officer at the Catholic Diocese of Clifton in Western England, and looks at the treatment of environmental issues in cinema.
Film entertains us, but should we expect more from film? It's certainly a good thing if film can make us think. Some might argue that's propaganda, while others would counter with the fact that every story is going to have a perspective, and we're grown up enough to form our own opinions. Usually it's a human story that we can relate to. I'm examining the role of the environment in film. In film we see lots of animals, but first they have to be humanised with actors' voices and emotions understandable to people before we can relate to them. If we're honest, every genre of film is person-centred. Horror films look at human fear, just as romantic comedies celebrate the love men and women feel for each other. What then is the hope for the environment in this reflection? A cynic might say that the natural world has a celebrated place in the marketing of new technology in the world of screen media. It's certainly hard to deny the commercial potential of marine life in the high definition of a plasma television, or the sensational depth of Avatar in 3D. However, another point of view would be that the beauty of creation sells the said technology because it resonates with more than our aesthetic senses. In the so-called golden age of 1950s Hollywood, filmmakers captured the feel of their day using space. John Ford used the expanse of barren space, desert, to express the solitude of the American hero. Again, in the new wave of the 1970s, filmmakers captured the space of their day, just like Martin Scorsese used urban claustrophobia to explore loneliness. Filmmakers today are using space, again in innovative ways, to express who we are and the issues pertinent to our time. As a people, we live in spatial reality. We can't be removed from our surroundings, and it's arguable that the way in which we relate to our natural environs says so much about us. Can we be likeable if we're wasteful with natural resources, or disrespectful of the world around us? In sacred scripture, the message of Genesis chapter 2 is that we should treat the earth as a gift from God. Our care for the world's natural resources ought to reflect the love we have for God. This is best reflected in the example of those who generally seek to love and be at peace with each other, a theme that is common to Pope Benedict's teaching. The irony of screen technology is that we are most at peace when we find time to stop and marvel at the beauty that surrounds us. After all, that's where fiction of film and the truth of our human nature meet.
That reflection came from Father Robert King, the interfaith officer at the Diocese of Clifton in England. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.